Again, this indicates so faintly the ever-operating, ever-supplying, ever-loving, ever-living Father, Mother, love, mind, soul, God. That's a positive statement, isn't it? And sometimes, after a positive statement such as that, we sometimes allow a little three-letter word to creep into our consciousness that obscures this vision of perfection, vision of reality, with a negative unreality. That little word is but. It's interesting, in the first chapter of Genesis, we read seven times it states that God saw everything that he'd made, and behold, it was very good. And seven stands for completeness, so creation was completely good. It was perfect. And then, for the first time in the Bible, the word but is used. In the second chapter of Genesis, it states, but there went up a mist from the earth. What mist are we allowing to obscure our vision of the perfection of creation by introducing or admitting this little word but? But what is it that turns my light off and leaves me in the dark? But what is this power opposing itself to God, to good? We hear on radio and read in the newspaper and certainly see on television every day reports of what might be called a power opposing itself to man's unity, to good. Now this little clipping I have is taken from, this happens to be from the Christian Science Monitor. For those of you who are visitors, this is not a religious newspaper. It's an international daily newspaper, as witness this little news that appeared some time ago in Britain. But it's an account that I think can be applied to the situation facing our dear country and our government today. In this account, the British are most upset over what they refer to as a disease affecting their unity. We were so splendid during the war, says this lady. We came together. What's happening now? There's no force uniting us. Something seems deeply wrong, but nobody seems to know what it is. All this uncertainty about, one just doesn't see the way out of it at all. Then the Prime Minister of Great Britain, Edward Heath, went on television speaking specifically to this point. He said the government is not about to quail before what he calls the invisible danger before the country. And finally, one individual says, we're trying to identify the enemy. We'd unite, she says, if we could unite against something. What is this power opposing itself to good, to God? Is it a power? It can't be a power, since God is all power. Then it must be a physical force. Well, then where does this physical force come from? Well, the swinging doors that we all came through to get in this auditorium, these doors have no more force than the push we ourselves give them. If we don't get behind it, that swinging door has no motivation, no activity, certainly no mind. In speaking of this opposing power, Mrs. Eddy writes in the Christian Science textbook, this is Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures. Now, opposite the marginal heading, opposing power, this one sentence seems to stand out. The foundation of evil is laid on a belief in something besides God. A belief in something besides God. We say, I don't believe in anything besides God? Of course not. That's ridiculous. But there it is. Sin which doth so easily beset us. One Bible translation phrases it, the sin which doth so deftly, so cleverly beset us. This opposing evil, negative, so-called force would seem to exert such a diabolical strategy that men have come to call it the devil, fallen down and worshipped it, feared it, which is the same thing, isn't it? Christian scientists often refer to this negative evil as the aggressive suggestion accepted into consciousness that God is not all. Or the pantheistic belief that God is both matter and mind. Another term that Christian Scientists use for this negative evil is animal magnetism. What do you think of when you hear that term, animal magnetism? As a teenager just beginning the study of Christian Science, I remember thinking, well, that's an archaic sounding expression, isn't it? Animal magnetism. I could picture a dog with iron filings clinging all over it. It wasn't until the Korean War that I began to get a clearer picture of animal magnetism, a facet of some ancient philosophy involved an insidious method of deceit which became known as brainwashing. This gave me the clue that I needed. At that particular time, I had just taken up the study of judo. Not because I had any antisocial tendencies, I assure you, but simply because I was doing a sort of slapstick comedy on television and I just wanted to learn how to fall properly. And judo is a great way to learn how to fall properly. How to fall anyway. It's interesting, the word judo means the soft way, the gentle art. And actually, it's only 100% effective if you can get the other fellow to come at you. And so in my first lessons, that's what the instructor did. He encouraged me to come at him. He even helped me to attack him. But always just a little bit faster than I should. And when I reached a slight state of overbalance, why, he just tripped me up. In other words, the opponent is led to believe that he's doing fine. He doesn't need to be careful. He's in complete control. Doesn't need to be on the defensive. In other words, he's led to put himself into a position where he's almost thrown himself. I caught on to this about the second year. Now the instructor realized he'd have to use deception. When I'd come in the morning, he'd make subtle remarks about what I might be able to do to him today. And some days he pretended to be very tired, very weak. I'll never forget one day he wore one of these elastic support bandages around his knee to indicate to me that he had a weak leg. I became overconfident in my powers of observation, my own intuition. I thought, I can handle this. I'll just move in on that good old weak leg. And that good old weak leg threw me 5 feet. See, this deception was an invitation. I didn't have to accept it. I caught on to that in about a year and a half. Now, the instructor knew that I would not be tempted to make the first move, so now he would pretend to move, I would react, and he would use the force of my own reaction to throw me. It's very difficult not to react to a sudden or surprising or frightening suggestion, isn't it? Well, I finally caught on to that. One day, we'd been working out for about half an hour, and I noticed the instructor hadn't been able to throw me cleanly. I thought this might be the day. I might finally win a match from this fella and be advanced in my grade. I resisted every temptation to react, refused every invitation to be deceived. Oh, I was doing beautifully. And then, he just opened his mouth and let out the most blood-curdling scream. I just froze. If he'd let go of me, I would have dropped. I had overlooked, or not been aware of a third method of attack. Deception, reaction, shock. Shock. And considering this later, it seemed to me at least, that this was somewhat indicative of the aggressive suggestion that Jesus faced in his temptation in the wilderness. Matthew records the tempter is saying, command that these stones be made bread. Bow down and worship me. Cast thyself down. Each time the tempter was trying to get Jesus to make the first move, to react, to do something to himself. In the Garden of Eden allegory, we read almost the same temptation presenting itself to Eve. The aggressive suggestion of a power, a creator opposed to or second to God, slithered into her consciousness, and Eve reacted. The account indicates that Eve attempted to reason with or to talk it over with this serpent thought, and Eve was thrown. When Jesus came down from the mount, this same tempter tried to get him to react to pictures of a divided, deceitful, hateful, sick, sinning community. But Jesus was not deceived. Then it attempted to shock him with pictures of treachery, a crucifixion, death, a tomb. But Jesus did not react to these pictures. He responded to God. Jesus knew he was going with his Father, and he knew these pictures did not come from a loving Father. Jesus didn't ignore the temptation to believe these pictures, but he was prepared. He was ready for that temptation. In speaking of this vital readiness, Mrs. Eddy writes in one of her prose works, one of her miscellaneous writings, "Not to know that a false claim is false is to be in danger of believing it. Hence the utility of knowing evil aright, then reducing its claim to its proper denominator, nobody and nothing." Of course, this aggressive suggestion of a power, a creator, opposed to God, will never approach our consciousness in a guise that we can recognize, or at a time we're expecting it. That's not the nature of the beast. But whatever tempts us to react with irritation, condemnation, hatred, discouragement, or disgust, we can be sure that's it. These words from miscellaneous writings would certainly indicate that Mary Baker Eddy was not deceived by this lying serpent of materialism. Those of you, perhaps this is your first Christian Science lecture, you may have heard of Mrs. Eddy spoken of as leader. Well, she's called a leader because she was first a listener. She listened. Not to the voice of conformity or to narrow, orthodox formalism, but instead she was receptive to the intelligence, which is a quality ever emanating from divine mind, a constant source of fresh, inspired ideas. She listened to this inspiration and then followed this inspiration instantly and implicitly. A good leader is a good listener. She listened to this Christ consciousness and found her own physical healing. And then after achieving this higher sense of health that she'd so long sought, Mrs. Eddy didn't leave it there. She continued to work, pray, to listen, and to be obedient to this divine influence ever present in human consciousness. And out of this consecration, she was led to establish in this book her revelation of this truth that heals. Each page of this textbook contains clear steps in the pathway of going with our Father. On one page, Mrs. Eddy writes, "Until belief becomes faith, and faith becomes spiritual understanding, human thought has little relation to the actual or divine." And so we can see three clear steps on that page. Belief in God becomes faith in the presence and power of God. And then comes spiritual understanding, in which absolute harmony is demonstrated. These three steps were very clearly exemplified in the life of Moses. I'm sure most of us are familiar with the account of Moses attending his father-in-law's sheep, and the account indicates that Moses came upon a bush that was burning with fire, and the bush was not consumed. And Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. Wouldn't this simply indicate that Moses was not impressed with the outward evidence, but was continually seeking the inner cause? Having reached this standpoint, it was now revealed to Moses that the place whereon he stood, his present state of consciousness, was holy ground. And from that very moment on, Moses began to lead the children of Israel out of Egypt. In this same way, a young boy, a member of my own family actually, was led out of his Egypt, his bondage, to what is referred to as an incurable disease. I witnessed this healing from beginning to end. This boy had availed himself of all loving, competent medical aid, but to no avail. He began to read this textbook, and though he could understand little of it at first, he soon saw he must take his stand radically, understandingly, for and with Christian Science. He must simply trust. One night, when it seemed as though he could stand or live through very little more of this suffering, he just opened the book at random, almost desperately. And these words stood out from the page to him. Take possession of your body and govern its feeling and action. Rise in the strength of spirit to resist all that is unlike good. God has made man capable of this, and nothing can vitiate the ability and power divinely bestowed on man. This boy saw clearly for the first time that all was under the direct control of that which had created all. He saw that he didn't need to fear death. He wasn't going anywhere. God being infinite and eternal all, there was nowhere else he could go. He had ever dwelt in this divine presence, whether he'd known it or not. And then an angel thought came to him that when the morning stars sang together, he had dwelt in the bosom of his Father. And that which was calling itself this very moment was in reality a part of eternity, a part of good, holy ground. Well, the boy sank back in bed with tears of gratitude. Interestingly enough, the physical picture hadn't changed at all. His body was still screaming its complaint, but he'd lost his fear. Suffering was replaced by these first two steps, belief and faith in God, which were soon to be transformed to the third step, spiritual understanding, because this disease suddenly took on a most alarming form. But this time the boy met the attack from the high standpoint of his newly gained spiritual understanding. He did not react. He looked beyond the smoke and flame of the burning bush sense evidence and saw deep within his spiritual indestructibility, his spiritual oneness with his Creator. He saw this not as a changeable, incurable disease, but simply a devilish temptation that he cast his high concept of man down to a mortal, material level of creation. He was not deceived. He saw it as a devilish demand that he bow down and worship a power opposing itself to good. He did not react. He saw it as a devilish denial of the fact that the disease had been cured when the fear was destroyed. For as he'd read in his textbook, when fear disappears, the foundation of disease is gone. This boy took possession of his body. He spoke aloud to his body in this way, the foundation of fear is gone. Fear and disease have therefore nothing to rest upon or to grow in. Fear and disease exist only as false beliefs, without foundation, without cause, without creator, and without a mind to believe them. It was a matter of moments, this disease just melted away. The boy was neither shocked nor surprised. He just went to sleep. The first peaceful, restful sleep he'd had in many, many months. He awoke grateful for what has since been proved to be a complete healing, but more grateful that he awoke to the divine fact that man does not have to wait weeks and months and years for a diseased condition to end. Disease has no end. It had no beginning, and it has no middle. Disease and discord exist only as false concepts. And when we take our firm stand for this truth, the place we are standing never ceases to be holy ground. How great was Moses' faith and simple trust, which became a prayer of spiritual understanding at the Red Sea, a prayer that can be applied to the situation facing our dear country and our dear government today, where with the sea in front of him and mountains on either side and an enemy behind him, Moses still didn't indicate from which direction he thought help should come. I'd like to read this very brief prayer of Moses as it was documented by the ancient Jewish historian General Josephus about the first century. This prayer can be found in any public library in the life of Flavius Josephus. You're all familiar with the situation, I'm sure, but allow me the old habit of setting the scene. There's the Red Sea right out there in the middle. Mountains towering high on either side. 5,000 Egyptian soldiers thundering up from behind. And Moses was surrounded by his own people who weren't too fond of him at that particular moment. And Moses prayed this simple prayer. Thou art not ignorant, O Lord, that it is beyond human strength and human contrivance to avoid the difficulties we are now under. We despair of any other assistance or contrivance and have recourse only to that hope we have in Thee. If there be any method that can promise us an escape by Thy providence, we look up to Thee for it. We are in a helpless place, but still, it is a place that thou possessest. Still the sea is thine. The mountains also that enclose us are thine. So that these mountains will open themselves if thou commandest them. The sea also, if thou commandest it, will become dry land. Nay, we might escape by a flight through the air, if thou shouldst determine we should have that way of salvation. With this simple trust and spiritual understanding, can we not believe that Moses took his first step before the waters parted? Confident that he was going with his father. Now, shall we go with our father? Let's go.